San Diego for the annual meeting of the Society for Neuroscience. There's people, 30,000 people trekking up and down between these various hotels. We're actually in the Grand Hyatt with officially Henry T. Greeley, otherwise known as Hank Greeley, who is the Dean F. and Kate Edelman Johnson Professor of Law at Stanford, but a whole bunch of other hats as well. Director of the Center for Law and Biosciences, Professor of Genetics of Stanford School of Medicine, and importantly for us, the Director of the Stanford Interdisciplinary Group on Neuroscience and Society, and Director of the Program in Neuroethics. Lots of these things, obviously, lots of these hats, because it is such an interdisciplinary effort. And as a satellite meeting, before the SFN itself started, there was a meeting of the Neuroethics Society, and you're on the executive of that. So I'd like to get some sense from you. We talked a little bit offline in the last couple of days about this sort of stuff, about where you think the Neuroethics Society currently is, whether you think it's coalesced on a specific mission or it's still finding its way. I'm just curious to get your read on that.
Yeah, I think those of us in the leadership of the Society are curious to figure that out too. It was founded 4 years ago. I was lucky enough to be one of the co-founders of it. We're currently about 250 members, 250 to 300 members. We are pleased with the progress we've made, but it's not, wherever we're headed, it's not there yet. Mm-hmm. We need to be bigger. We need to be more active. We need to have more than just one annual meeting a year. We need committees, working groups, other things. We're confident that we can do that because, not because of our own merits, but because the issues are so fascinating, important, it's cool, that people will want to explore them. So I think the Neuroethics Society needs to get bigger, broader, and more active. We need to figure out other ways to engage our members in these activities, and we're working on it. My hope is when we hold our next meeting on the Friday before the Society for Neuroscience annual meeting next year, in hopes of getting some of those 31,000 attendees to come early, I hope we'll have twice as big, 2 to 3 times as large a meeting, 2 to 3 times as big a membership, and a lot more going on that the Society has sponsored or catalyzed.
Yeah. Tell me about the relationship. I asked Judy Ellis this, and Steve Hyman, and Paul Root-Walpe, the distinction between, or the connection between, if you want, the field of bioethics and neuroethics. And then talk to me about the role of neuroscience in all of this sort of thing. And I'm thinking about Pat Churchland's talk, you know, sure, where she's talking very much about the role of rules playing in navigating the social world. She's talking about neuroscience, the underpinnings there of oxytocin, you know, and so on and so forth. So
Pat, whose degree is in philosophy. I think she's a wonderful example of the kinds of things the Neuroethics Society should be about. The questions you've asked, I suspect if you ask 10 people involved in the Society, you'd get 15 different answers. So I don't think there's any consensus on it. My own view is that neuroethics is related to, part of, largely but not entirely overlapping with bioethics. People have different views about what bioethics is as well. I like to think of it as a field. It's like Latin American studies, right? You're not a Latin American studiesologist. You're an economist or a historian or a linguist or a literature person who finds his or her inspiration and work in that field. I view myself as a law professor, legal training, who works in neuroethics and works in bioethics, and much of the neuroethics could also be called bioethics, but not necessarily all of it. So I don't think we will see departments of neuroethics. I don't think we should see departments of neuroethics. I think we will see neuroethics centers, neuroethics initiatives, neuroethics programs, bringing together people from lots and lots of different areas. Which leads me, in a sense, to the last part of your question. How does the neuroscience and how do the neuroscientists fit in? Right now, I think, well, and I hope we can keep that. One of the things that bothers me a little bit about bioethics is that bioethics has become less open and welcoming, I think, to scientists and physicians than it was in its initiation. It's become more dominated by lawyers, philosophers, theologians, etc. Now, it started out with the lawyers, philosophers, theologians, but with a large, but with more interaction with the actual physicians, starting really as an offshoot of medical ethics. Neuroethics so far, and part of this, I think, really does, is owed to Steve Hyman as the president of the Neuroethics Society, a scientist himself, and the interest of scientists in the ethical issues. The scientists themselves have been driving much of the ethics discussion. I think we have a closer association between the scientists and the non-scientists, which I think is going to be absolutely crucial to making progress. If you keep the two separate, if you've just got the outsiders to the science talking among themselves about, well, what does this scientific change mean? Where will this lead us? You run the serious risk that what you think, where you think science is going is wrong, or that you don't understand fully the limitations as well as some of the possibilities of the science. Having the scientists intimately involved is hugely important in my view.
Well, just devil's advocate position, just to widen this out. A lot of these issues are very pragmatic issues. They're end-of-life issues or stem cell issues or mens rea issues. They're often things where, in fact, you do bring lawyers in and ethicists and, yes, theologians. And their argument, the argument of some people might be, well, yeah, we understand that there's brain doing all of this and neuroscience is important, but what is the neuroscience bringing to the picture that we couldn't have figured out ourselves if we'd thought carefully and hard about it?
So I can understand that perspective. I think it's wrong, usually, maybe not always. But what the neuroscience is often bringing is a new set of new pieces of evidence, new sets of understandings, new ways of trying to get at things. So let me give you an example from my work. I've worked a lot on fMRI-based lie detection and other forms of neuroimaging-based lie detection. We've been worried about detecting lies for a long time. We've got different ways to try to do it, from polygraphs to oaths to looking in your eyes and seeing if I think you're an honest soul. We know that those work a little bit. We know they don't work real well. Neuroscience may give us better ways for it to work. If we just take as lawyers or philosophers or others, once we read some neuroscience articles and say, aha, this works or this doesn't work, we're going to make bad decisions. Because it takes, I think, substantial neuroscience sophistication, preferably from neuroscientists working with you in understanding the implications to tell you, well, how well does this work? You can't just say this works. You need to look at it more closely. For example, you might pick up a strong signal. You think it's a deception signal. It might be a signal about salience, about attention. You're being asked the questions. You get to the question about the money question, about whether or not you were at the murder scene. And your brain changes. Maybe it's because you're telling a lie. Maybe it's because you realize, oh, this is the important question. Yeah. This is the one they're really paying attention to. Figuring out whether the experiments, what the experiments tell us and how applicable they are to the real world. Most of these experiments take place with college undergrads who are being paid $50 to lie in a scanner. What relationship that has to people who are under arrest, who are worried about going to prison, what their brains look like, are subtle questions that real involvement with neuroscientists and with people who do experimental design work, with psychologists and others, that kind of interaction is essential for us to understand what those studies mean, and understanding them correctly makes a huge difference in how well we apply them.
Yeah. So we're still in terms of that we're still in somewhat of a proceed with caution stage, although plainly in a parallel instance use of DNA evidence has evolved over time. There's now people getting out of jail because they didn't do it.
Yes, although there are still areas of DNA evidence where we are in proceed with caution. Yeah. And I think there are areas of neuroscience, neuroimaging, where we are beyond proceed with caution, not so much in the law yet, but say neurosurgery. You have a tumor in the back of your brain near the visual cortex. Everyone's visual cortex is back here. Everyone's visual cortex is in a little different spot. We would like, in taking out the tumor, to take out as little of your visual cortex as possible. Well, we put you in a scanner and we show you pictures. And we do fMRI, just like the researchers are doing. And we use it to see where does your visual cortex, where does Roger's visual cortex right. start and stop. That's past the proceed with caution. That's there.
Right.
What, in terms of less medical, more social applications, I don't know that there's anything that's there yet, but I think we're getting close.
We'll move on to something like cognitive enhancements, which is very much obviously a brain-based thing.
Yeah.
I mean, where's that? What are the...
Give me a cup of coffee and I'll tell you.
You want a cognitive enhancement?
Cognitive enhancements have been around for a long time.
Okay.
I just had a cup of coffee. Right. I'm not sure it worked, but... We've used cognitive enhancers for a long time. We're now getting better ones, or different ones at least. Adderall and Ritalin, widely prescribed in the U.S. for attention deficit disorder and attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Maybe even more widely used on college campuses by people who don't have a diagnosis, but buy or borrow a pill from a friend to help them study. One of the most recent studies of college campus use from the University of Kentucky showed 34% of the undergrads from a sample of 1,600, 34% had used Adderall or Ritalin without a prescription during their college years. Of the juniors and seniors, 54%. Of the Greeks, which in this context is not someone from Athens, but a fraternity or sorority, over 75%. Now, it's actually unclear whether Adderall and Ritalin really help people who don't have ADD do better. Helps keep them awake, and that can do better, may or may not actually help. If it helps, it's probably not very much. It's probably not much more than a cup of coffee, and it's got more risks than a cup of coffee. But what about the next generation? I'm confident with the billions of dollars that are being spent that we will eventually come up with some medications to improve memory. And we'll come up with them in order to help people with Alzheimer's disease or other forms of dementia begin to keep their abilities to make, retain, and retrieve memory better. But what happens if those work for 20-year-olds? What happens if taking organic chemistry, which is, for bizarre reasons, the gateway to medical school in the United States, and involves incredible amounts of memorization, what happens if half the kids are taking memory pills and half the kids aren't? We're going to have to answer those questions soon. Right now, there's kind of a reflexive, oh, it's like Barry Bonds and steroids. Maybe that's right, maybe that's not right. We need to think about that more, and that's likely to hit us. It's already here to some extent with Adderall and Ritalin, modafinil and a few other drugs. It's likely to hit us more soon. So I think these questions, one of the great things about neuroethics, they're some of the deepest possible questions. What does it mean to be human? What do we have free will? Can we make choices or not? And then there are these very applied, kind of my side, I'm not the deep thinker, I'm the boots on the ground. What are we going to do when we get brain-enhancing drugs? What are we going to do with the bar examination or with organic chemistry tests? What are we going to do in the law?
This is one of the questions that I was asking you actually on the floor of the day of the meeting, which is that given these very pragmatic, practical, as you say, boots on the ground issues that are at bedside or in courtroom or wherever.
In the classroom.
Classroom. How much is that, the discipline as it emerges, still tethered to the larger big M field of morality? And let me just read you this opinion special from October 16th, 2010 in New Scientist, piece by Fiery Cushman, where he says, we've long thought of moral laws as fixed points of reality, self-evident truths rooted in divine command or in some Platonic realm of absolute rights and wrongs. New research offering an alternative, explaining moral attitudes in the context of evolution, culture, and the neural architecture of our brains. This apparent reduction of morality to a scientific specimen can seem threatening, but it needn't. Rather, by unmasking our minds as the authors of morality, we may be better able to bend its narrative arc towards a happy end.
Bending narrative arcs has never been my specialty. So I got a couple reactions to that. First, I don't think there's anything wrong with a field that encompasses fundamental questions of morality and questions about whether or not employers should be able to use polygraphs on, or use lie detection on their employees. I think that going from very deep philosophical questions to very practical questions shouldn't be a problem. We should celebrate it. Mm-hmm. And that both sides can contribute to each other. That some sense of the uncertainties and the depths in our understandings of morality are somewhat useful in thinking about practical cases. And maybe this is my common law training, thinking about specific cases is often useful in thinking about broad principles, I believe. So I think they're not inconsistent. They are perfectly consistent and, in fact, complementary. In terms of the issue that was raised to some extent in that commentary, what will neuroscience tell us about morality itself? There, I have to confess, I'm a little more skeptical. I think it can tell us things, I think it may well be able to tell us things about how our brains make moral decisions, and that may be different from how they make immoral decisions, how they make non-moral decisions. Josh Green and others have done a lot of work on that. And that will be interesting and may be useful and may actually be useful in a more practical way if you're looking at prisoners and trying to decide what length sentence or what kind of sentence to give them. It may make sense to see, well, do these guys think about morality? Does the moral reasoning in their brain work the same way as most people? That could be a practical implication. I do not think that neuroscience will give us a new Ten Commandments produced by fMRI. It is possible that science will tell us most humans, most of the time, are inclined by some combination of genetics, environment, chance, brain architecture, to decide these kinds of moral questions in the following way. It might be able to tell us something about what is and why it is in terms of how our operative morality works. But I'm still hung up with David Hume in the question of, does is imply ought? And I think it doesn't. It would be interesting to know that there is some underlying moral instinct that leads 98% of the world, that you can tell by looking in their brains, causes 98% of the world to say this is good and this is bad. That's an interesting piece of knowledge, but that doesn't necessarily mean that 98% is right and the 2% is wrong. That sort of decision, that normative decision, I don't think science will determine or even necessarily be that helpful with.
We had a...
I could be wrong.
Well, we just got back from Arizona State University where we did a panel, which is up on the Science Network as we speak. We are now in the November the 15th.
Yes.
And we had a panel there that looked at the origins of morality. And we had a look at the David Hume thing. And I there was a sense, certainly from Pat and Pat Churchton, in particular, and from Simon Blackburn, also commentaries from Steven Pinker and Sam Harris, that the notion of the strict logical derivation of an ought from an is wasn't what Hume was really getting at, and that, you know,
I'll certainly defer to Pat for an understanding of Hume.
It'd be fun to have a look at that. We can talk the sort of notion of possibly, in Pat's language, morality being one of the things that also has constraint satisfaction problems going on, I think was rather interesting as well. So it
serves me right for dropping a philosopher's name. Whether it's Hume's idea of is it ought or not doesn't change my concern that is doesn't tell us very much about ought. And particularly, whatever our brains may have evolved for in the course of our species history, on the savanna, hunter-gatherers, early agriculturalists, or whatever, I find it difficult to see how that will necessarily tell us how we should behave in the world we've created for ourselves today. What does our brain's evolved morality necessarily tell us about whether or not we should do human reproductive cloning? It may tell us something about how people will react to it. It may tell us something about why people react to it in a given way. That may be useful information in trying to figure out what the consequences are of banning it or legalizing it. But fundamentally, will it tell us this is a moral thing, this is an immoral thing? I don't see it.
You come to this from a lawyer's perspective, right? Because
recovery lawyer.
Okay, lawyer in recovery. You actually practiced in a law firm, but you also, and I'm looking at my little cheat sheet here, you're also a partner at, in a law firm, staff assistant secretary of the U.S. Department of Energy. This is an interesting collection of things.
Staff assistant is young gopher, but...
Special assistant at the general counsel of the U.S. Department of Defense, law clerk to Justice Potter Stewart of the U.S. Supreme Court, and Judge John Minor Wisdom of the Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. So. An eclectic sort of background.
Couldn't keep a job.
Oh, okay. All right. How did you get into the law in the first place?
Was it parents? Well,
role models, mentors, deep passion, burning for the understanding
of
the law?
All yes, all no.
Search for income.
My father was went to law school, graduated, passed the bar, went to night law school. By the time he passed the bar, he had a well-paying day job, a wife, and three kids, so he never practiced until after he retired. So I have a family connection, but it was sort of an odd family connection. I think when I was a freshman in college, I was uncertain. Did I want to go into, I didn't really think about it as law exactly, but policy, government kind of work, or did I want to go into science? Did I want to be a scientist? I had no idea what kind of scientist, but I'd always been good at math and science, and it intrigued me. I'd loved science fiction as a kid. But so did politics, government, policy. The third quarter of calculus and analytic geometry, the second midterm, convinced me not to go into science. My native math ability deserted me without warning. I think I overreacted, actually, but I said, okay, there are people who are a lot better at this than I am. I better be a lawyer. I better think about the political science, government, policy kinds of issues. Mm-hmm. And if that's what interests you, law is a wonderful way into it. Lawyers we're kind of the grease of societies, at least American society. Now, lawyers play a much bigger and different role in the U.S. than they do almost anywhere else. But we're the grease. We make the wheels run, make them turn. And as a result, very little can happen in the U.S. without the involvement of law. That makes the law a very useful tool for trying to change policy, affect policy, to try to make it a better world. So I never went to law school thinking I wanted to be a lawyer. I went to law school because lawyers have a huge opportunity and huge influence on policy, on what the world's going to look like, and that's what I wanted to do. In a way, I think that's still what I want to do. Part of my interest in neuroethics is trying to figure out how to structure our societies and policies so that this new knowledge, these new technologies, get used in ways that maximize their benefits and minimize their harms.
Well, let me ask you about the policy, because in the presentation again at the meeting, Steve Hyman and Alan Leshner, both said, not ironically, I mean, it was more wryly than anything, that scientists really think they're going to get science information to influence policy, then you should think again, it doesn't really happen as much as you'd expect. And as one looks at the team that's in there, the kind of people that are in there, now the scientists that are assisting the president, that's pretty much a dream team of scientists. You'd think that collected wisdom would be extremely useful in forming policy. Having said that, if the president came in and said that his aim of his administration, one aim of it, was to restore science to its rightful place, what is the rightful place, given what we've just said about policy? What is the rightful place of science in the society?
I think the rightful place is to provide true answers to questions that are subject to true answers, with true there kind of in quotes, but true understood within the context of what is and isn't knowable and how confident we can be in the results. One of the things I think laymen often misunderstand about science, they think when a scientist says X is true, that means definitely, positively true and true forever. And it's really more a contingent statement. It's true right now. It looks right. Somebody comes up with an experiment that disproves it. Well, then we make a new model of what the world looks like. So I think part of it is scientists on issues where science can provide reliable, useful information, providing that information and providing it in a way that the policymakers can understand. The policymakers may or may not choose to act on it in the way the scientists think they should. Ultimately, I think science is part of its culture, part of its society, is governed by its society. Some friends of mine have argued with me we should believe that we have a First Amendment right to freedom of research in the context of the stem cell argument, and I don't buy it. We live within our society. Science lives within our society. It is already enormously governed by our society in ways that we don't necessarily think about. So I think that the study of astrophysics and star evolution is really interesting. It doesn't get nearly as much funding as the NIH has. Why is that? Because the science our society wants is science about health. If you're a linguist, fascinating science. Historical linguistics, great stuff. Funding 1/10,000. Of NIMH, because society has its values, and that leads to where you get funding either from the government, from foundations, or from private industry. So science is controlled, well, influenced by social values. It will be, and it should be. If the United States were to vote to ban embryonic stem cell research, I think it would be a mistake. But if that's what if the country wants to make a dumb mistake, I'll argue against it, and after they do it, I'll argue they should change it. But I think that's the government's right. At least, you know, I have a bias toward democratic, liberal democratic, open societies. Mm-hmm. In that context, if the people want to do something foolish, it's their right to do something foolish. I do think, and this is paraphrasing Churchill, democracy is the worst form of government. Except for all the others the mind of man has tried from time to time. It's messy and it's ugly, and at best it muddles through, but it's much less likely to mess up, at least long-term, in a continuing way, than non-democratic governments, if only because you can throw the rascals out. So science and government, I think science has an important role to play in providing information, in arguing from that information about what the problems are and what methods have a better chance of dealing with those problems. In the long run, though, if the society working through its legitimately constituted government decides to reject the scientific evidence, so be it. Move away from South Dakota.
Isn't that one of the problems, though, in conveying exactly how science is done? And is that something that perhaps the administration has failed to do sufficiently well, which is to make clear that science is indeed a moving target, that it's not, we're not in the belief business, we're in the doubt business,
yeah.
That there's no certitude. It's kind of hard to sell that to a public, though, which is looking for results and facts.
It is true, and it's hard to sell it to science journalists. In many cases, it's even hard to sell it to TV directors and producers. Not all of them, thankfully, but we like...
You're in the land free of the tyranny of the soundbite at this moment, Hank, as you know. So.
Yeah, we like certain answers, and even scientists and lawyers in their personal lives would like certain answers. We like them, editors like them, headline writers like them, news organizations like them. There are pressures, there are constant pressures to be more certain than you actually are. Scientists need to have the discipline to keep saying, well, this is what we think now, but it could change. Yeah. Because the alternative, and we're seeing this particularly with respect to dietary advice, right? every 6 months, it seems the advice changes 180 degrees. And as a result, no one believes anything. Or maybe worse, everyone reads one thing that they like and believes that and refuses to hear anything else. If there's an article out there that says chocolate chip cookies are good for you, you know, I'll read that and believe that and ignore everything else because everything else keeps changing. Well, I do think the public needs to understand more this contingent nature of science, and not that it's entirely contingent. Einstein did not overthrow Newton's theory of gravitation. He tweaked it. He modified it. The current standard model of physics seems to be working awfully well, but there's some uncertainties there. It may get changed, but that won't mean that E equals mc squared is wrong. It'll mean it's not the whole story. Sometimes science does completely change things. Plate tectonics completely changed our understanding of how the continents and the Earth's crust was created, and it worked. But plate tectonics keeps getting tinkered with. Yeah. People need to know that it is a continuing, contingent, provisional set of truths. One of the hallmarks of science is you can think up ways to try to disprove it. If you can't think up a way to try to disprove it, then maybe you shouldn't call it science. But is that President Obama's responsibility? He's not even a scientist. Although I think he has more appreciation for science than many politicians. Yeah, it would be great if he could spend some time and attention on that. But the man does have a lot on his plate. I think that scientists and those of us who work in science, I'm not a scientist, but I work in and on science. I think scientists and fellow travelers like me, like you, do need to keep stressing this contingent, changeable, not carved in stone nature of science, both because it's right and because it will give the public and decision makers a better understanding of how hard the questions they have to answer are. We want our questions to have easy answers, and they usually don't.
But I'm just going back a little bit, circling back to the notion of the mission of the Neuroethics Society.
Yes.
And so on. Just to make clear, you are totally supportive, as I understand it, of, I mean, this happens to be a paper I'm carrying around at the moment. It's a very recent PNAS paper. Molly Crockett's paper on serotonin selectively influences moral judgment, behavior through effects on harm aversion, nice commentary, I fear for you, a role for serotonin in moral behavior. I mean, these are the sorts of things that actually do bring light into the picture,
it seems
to me.
And I'm in favor of that research. I think it's fascinating. What I don't think is that will lead us to be able to say, and so neuroscience tells us that here are the 10 rules, the 10 commandments we should all follow. Neuroscientists may tell us, here are 10 commandments that it's easier or more difficult for people to follow given their brain structure and the way their brains work. May be able to tell us, here are 10 commandments that people are more inclined to follow because of how their brains are structured and how they work. But I don't think they can ever tell us, here are 10 commandments people should follow. I'm not sure who can convincingly tell us that. And I think that's one of the great dilemmas and difficulties of being human, trying to act in a moral way when your knowledge about what's moral is, for many of us at least, somewhat uncertain and contingent.
As you said, you're not a scientist, but you are the co-chair of the MacArthur Law and Neuroscience Project.
I was one of the co-directors.
With scientists. We were at a meeting at Vanderbilt together recently, presenting on these sorts of issues, which involve a lot of science. One question I like to ask people, and I will ask you, is, as a fellow traveler, is what's your advice to a young scientist? They must come to you in your position as a...
Sometimes, although the different people come with different kinds of questions. But in line with the neuroethics kinds of areas, one thing I say is think about these ethical issues in your work. If you're doing work with C. elegans, maybe they don't come up very much, but they may still. If your work with C. elegans tells you something fundamental about how memories are made in worms, it may have implications for how memories are made in people. which may have implications for the courtroom or for Alzheimer's disease or for a bunch of things. Think about it in your own work. Think about it, even if it's not in your work, and how neuroscience affects the public and policy. Get involved, join the Neuroethics Society, go to talks at your university, join groups, get involved in how neuroscience will affect society, because whether you get involved or not, neuroscience will affect society. If neuroscientists are not very involved, it is my strong bet that it will affect society in worse ways than if they are involved, because the non-neuroscientists will look for the easy answers from misunderstood, poorly contextualized neuroscience results and make a hash of it. Only if we have continued involvement of neuroscientists who can say, you know, this study doesn't actually mean what you think it means, or that's a good start, but here's what you'd have to do to really be convinced of that, or, you know, look at this specificity. This means that 10% of the time these people aren't what you think they are. Only when you've got that kind of sophisticated criticism and analysis from people who understand the science do you stand a decent chance, I think, of applying the science in good ways.
Now you look back, is this trajectory make total sense to you? Is this always what you wanted to have done, or are you a frustrated country and western singer? I mean, is there something else you would have rather done?
You know, in my next life, maybe a historical linguist or a geophysicist, or if I had a voice, I wouldn't mind being a singer-songwriter, but I'd have to have more talent than I have in this lifetime. Okay. Yes. So basically, Roger, the answer is yes and no. Today, this makes perfect sense. This is what I always wanted to do, but I had no idea of that while I was doing it. The retrospectoscope is the world's greatest scientific instrument because it's always right. Given how my life has moved and evolved, this is the perfect job for me, the perfect place for me, and I'm very happy and grateful. I'm not sure who or what I'm grateful to, but I'm very grateful that I've ended up doing what I'm doing. It grows out of what I did, but had my native math ability not deserted me on integration by trig substitution, I might be a physicist, or I might be a cab driver. My life could have taken different turns in lots of ways, and for many of those turns, I probably would be saying today the same thing. I ended up in the perfect spot for me. At least I hope so.
A question I like to ask people is, if I give you a time travel token, you can bring anybody Ooh. From anywhere, any discipline, whatever, to your dinner table, who would you like to talk to?
Does it also include translation?
Anybody.
So I can bring somebody who wouldn't speak my language.
Absolutely.
If I could talk to anyone. Jane Austen.
Oh, and you could probably speak her language.
Not as well.
Because of the...
I just think she's the greatest novelist in the English language. And to get some sense of how she did that, or her understanding of how she did that. And Shakespeare's another possibility, but Shakespeare is somehow his genius seems less accessible. I'm sure her genius ultimately is equally inaccessible, but it feels more comfortable. I think maybe Jane Austen, but that could be influenced by the fact that I'm rereading Pride and Prejudice for the 10th time right now.
Okay. Final question, because I know you have to go. What are you optimistic about?
I'm optimistic. I'm an optimistic guy. I think the glass is at least 60% full. I think that, but I'm a qualified optimist. I think I'm a realistic optimist. I think we will continue to muddle through. You know, one of the areas I work in is ethical, legal, and social issues in genetics. We didn't get that all right. We've had some fits and starts, terrible ones earlier in the 20th century with the eugenics movement. But in the last 20 years, as the science has gotten better, we've worried about these things, and we've done okay. It's not over yet. We need to continue to watch and change, but we've muddled through pretty well. I think we'll do the same thing with neuroscience. I think fundamentally, we are likely to make not terrible decisions, but I think our decisions will be less terrible. The chances of terrible decisions will be lower the more of us think about these issues in advance and have some sense of what's coming down the line, what kinds of questions they're going to pose for us. To the extent that we can keep neuroscientists interested in ethical and policy issues and get ethics and policy people to be willing to listen to some of the qualifications and qualms and yes maybes and sort ofs that the neuroscientists give them, beyond just reading the headline in the newspaper that summarizes the abstract of a paper and says neuroscience can now do this. I'm optimistic that will happen. I think it'll continue to take work and diligence and good luck. But fundamentally, I'm an optimistic guy, and even more deeply, I'm an academic, I have a bias. Knowledge is good, more knowledge is better. And there are some instances where in my personal lives that may not be true, but I have to believe that this incredible explosion of knowledge about the human brain and how it works, where really we know infinitely more now than we did 30 years ago, and we know zero compared to what we're going to know 30 years from now, that will have to have some really wonderful consequences in improving, in eliminating human suffering, in restricting or eliminating some mental illnesses or neurological diseases, help people live happier, better lives. That's a wonderful plus, and I look forward to it.
Hank Greeley, thanks very much.
Thank you, Roger. Always a pleasure.
Thank you.